I got the CD about 2 weeks ago, and I've listened to it about three times, but in the middle of the afternoon, when I'm doing some paperwork, I just like to I go through all the CDs that I've subscribed for about a year now. This is the first time I phoned in, though.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. Welcome aboard.
Thanks.
What prompted you? Well, first of all, Kevin, tell me a little bit about your business. Tell me more about it.
I've been in business in this site for 16 years. First 8 years, it was a franchised roadhouse. We did about $1.8 million, but 85% of that was alcohol. Food was the second. It was an afterthought, actually. And then 8 years ago, the franchise went down, so I went independent, and now we're just a casual family restaurant specializing in steaks and ribs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking to renovate to increase our seating capacity because I got a bar area that takes up about a third of my floor space, but it's about 10 to 15% of my business.
Mm-hmm. Have you flipped the mix then on the food liquor?
It's completely opposite now.
Isn't that great?
85% food and 15% liquor.
Oh, that's super.
Well, what do you think your biggest challenges are since you've flipped it over 8 years ago?
It's going to take a while to, I'd like to renovate, but I know my balance sheet isn't strong enough. And I guess one of the reasons I phoned today is I'd like to hear find out how you do a weekly P&L statement that you mentioned that your flat top grill restaurants do.
No, that's great. Well, it is a learning process. It took us a few months to get it in. When I arrived, they couldn't even read a P&L statement. And what we did was, the first, I would say, 4 months, I met with the general managers after the end of each period, and I just taught them how to read it and what it was and where their costs went. And then the next thing we did was we went through each line item and taught them how to order and check invoices and code invoices before they sent them to the corporate office.
So we've got, excuse me just a second, Loretta. We got a couple of new folks that just joined us, I think.
Oh, sure.
Hi, this is Edmund. Just stopping in.
Hey, okay. I figured you'd probably show up sometime, my friend.
Yes, sir. I am on a mobile phone for the next 15 minutes, so I do apologize for that.
Okay. We got anybody else? I know Kevin.
It's Tim Warman from Smugglers Inn in Calgary.
Oh, great. Great. This must be Canadian night.
Absolutely.
So that's good.
So we got Edmund and Tim. Okay.
And Kevin Ross from Peterborough had raised a question about how she was doing the weekly P&L, so that's kind of what she came in the middle of.
Enjoying it.
Okay, so having said that.
Right. Well, what we did was, after we taught them how to do it, we actually generated an Excel spreadsheet that had each line item on it, a summary for every week, and then as backup sheets, we had declining balances for each line item. So we roughly, you know, it took a couple months to work the bugs out. Like, you know, some of them were putting their entire utility bill in the first week, which, of course, skewed those results and didn't even out to the end of the period. But after we got all the bugs worked out, there were fixed costs in there, and, of course, it worked against the budget, both in terms of real dollars and in terms of percentage of sales. So what would happen would be literally every day, they could see where they were, you know, on what we used to call the holy trinity, the liquor, the food, and the labor, and could see how that labor was something we worked hard to get back into control. They could see immediately how labor percentage of sales. And then we taught them to go to the POS system and do a labor by hour analysis, which, of course, they had never even thought of before. And as a result of that, some of them cut back their hours, which I was very proud of them for, you know, having the leadership skill to do that. So, but as a result, Kevin, to get back to your question, by midnight on Tuesday, they got the GL, the general ledger, from the corporate office on Monday, and we gave them one day to check that against their numbers to make sure it balanced. And then by midnight on Tuesday, their weekly P&L spreadsheet had to be sent to us, along with the declining balances behind it. And we would check it early Wednesday morning. We always had our ops meeting on Wednesday mornings at 9. And at that point, then, we would be able to take a look and predict, week by week, where we thought we would be consolidated by the end of the period and then make adjustments accordingly in the bigger picture. So it really gave everybody a lot more awareness, literally day by day, minute by minute, in terms of where we were individually as restaurants and then consolidated as a company. One of the other things we did on the cover spreadsheet that actually had the totals of the P&L was we did week one and then week two and then a week one and two combined, and then week three and then week one, two, three combined. So we really could predict. But I'll tell you, from a corporate standpoint, our biggest predictions came after the end of week two.
Did you have to do like a weekly food inventory, or did you go?
Yes, thank you. I forgot that part. Absolutely. When I got there, they did. It was just very loose the way they did inventories, and there was a lot of there wasn't uniformity in what was counted and so forth. But yes, they have to do their food and liquor inventories, and we made two of them do it together. That the GM and the chef
okay.
had to do it together, either on Sunday night after close or Monday morning before open. And, you know, I thought, oh, I'm going to get big pushback on this because that had been my experience. They loved it. They loved doing the inventory. They loved realizing, oh, my God, look at all this junk that's sitting on this back shelf back here that, you know, I'm
yeah.
paying for. So it was really a great, great learning experience for them. And once they got a handle on how to do the whole P&L, they loved it.
Yeah.
Because it gave them the tools, the real hard facts and hard data that they need to run their business day in and day out. I mean, they started coming up with creative ways to, you know, man the host desk when business slowed down in the afternoons. It was really very good. But in the whole process, we never dropped the standards. We really held them accountable for maintaining the standards. It's amazing how they got creative. And then they would come to their GM meetings, and about the fourth month that I was there, they really had this under their belt, and I would make them start reporting it. And I started out, I developed a worksheet for them, you know, what percentage is this, all the ratios. And by the fifth month, it was so cool to watch them grow and develop, and I just sat back and let them teach each other at that point. It was great.
Good idea. I find sometimes my food cost starts creeping up again, and I've always, you know, are prices going up that high, or... is our sales mix changing or whatever?
And, yeah.
You lose control of it. You know, even a month you can lose control of it.
Absolutely. One of the other things that our board required us to do that I had never done before, a lot of the board members are retired manufacturing owners. And they, I guess in that industry, they always did a period index. They take 15 items and month by month, compare the price on a spreadsheet. So they made us do it with 15 food items. Some of them were high usage items, some of them weren't. And same thing for liquor. And then period by period, we can look and see instantly if the food cost was a function of a raise in cost or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, once you get into that whole idea of food cost is up a point or two, you know, you get to teach them about theft and security, and we put peepholes in the back doors and made them start closing and locking the back doors, and, you know, all that stuff that they had not been doing before I got there. So things got pretty quickly, you know, whipped into shape, but, you know, this is just basic operational stuff that they needed to learn.
Yeah, being in business that long, too, you kind of lose track of it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and in our concept, it was, you know, a create your own stir fry. So we had, and everything we served was out on the line and the guests could see it. And, you know, I obviously did line checks constantly, but when you walk through and you see that the bok choy is wilting, well, there's an opportunity to teach. Why? Are we buying too much? Are we prepping too much? Are we not, you know, what's going on? Are we not storing it correctly? So it's you know, it's all pretty obvious. And every time I would see that, I would take the GM or the manager aside and I would show them how that can affect their weekly P&L. And the light bulbs just went on constantly. It was just
yeah.
very cool to watch.
Maybe it's time to get back and do inventories myself.
Yeah, I think you'll learn a lot if you do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Tim, this is the first time you've called in, too.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
What prompted your interest this time? I'm going to give you enough advance warning that you could skip.
I just finished listening to it 10 minutes ago, and I have a binder that I keep the paper that you send plus the
things oh, yeah.
all in a binder, and I'm going, hey, that's today, and it's 3:29. I'll phone this one.
Good,
the timing was good. I'm usually quite busy with the weekend paperwork right now, but I'm glad I called.
Great.
Good. Me too.
So any questions in particular? You're just calling to
I was more interested in the weekly P&L statements, and I think I'm going to move towards maybe start off with, you know, twice a month right now.
Mm-hmm.
We start seeing some improvement, and if we don't, then, you know, it justifies going into once a week. And, you know, I've got a kitchen manager that's been with me for 16 years, and I think he's, you know, he doesn't want to get into doing all the inventories and the extension of it, but I think it's an important part of, you know, I think we're going to be looking at some tough times over the next little while, and if we don't look after, you know, our profit and loss right now, it can only get worse.
Kevin, you're in Canada too, right?
Yeah.
What are you guys finding with the economy in Canada right now?
I'm a director of the Ontario Restaurant Association, and we've just done a survey. They just want to find out how, you know, the events of September 11th have affected us. I know in Toronto and some of the border communities, it's been quite drastic, but I'm about 100 miles north of Toronto, and I was up 1% in September. I was down 3% in October. So I've got some mixed messages out there right now. But my sales, that's my sales. My guest counts are down about twice as much, like 6% and 2%. So
mm-hmm.
guest counts are important as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what happens in the United States, we lag behind. So if you're going through some really tough times now, it's going to be really tough times for us in 2 or 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the impact at the moment kind of depends. I've been talking to a lot of people, and it kind of depends on where your market is. If your market was primarily local and you were sort of a mid-scale operation, it's been a little less impact than if you drew from travelers and convention people and,
yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. If you had a large restaurant in Orlando, I think you're in some major trouble.
You know, it's interesting you say that, Bill. I was just down in Boca Raton this last week speaking at a conference, and, oh, my, are they hurting.
Yeah.
And not just restaurants, but retail. You know, I was kind of chomping at the bit to go do some shopping down there. And not only were the stores empty or very close to empty, but the salespeople were, and this surprised me, they were a little nasty. You could tell they were angry and on edge.
Yeah.
And, you know, I almost felt sorry for them, but you could just really feel the impact on all levels.
Wow. Well, I mean, at least you know, you'd be in better shape with a restaurant. At least you can sell meals to the locals. If you got a hotel, I've got to think that you're in a world of hurt.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, Edmund, you got anything on your mind, or?
Actually, yeah, I have a couple of questions, but they're sort of all over the board, not any particular theme. The first question is on my list is that when you're building this chain that you're building and you have 5 units in Chicago, how do you jump to a place like D.C.? I mean, why not somewhere closer? I mean, what's the thinking behind something like that?
Great question. The D.C. markets were built, restaurants were built, not this past summer, but the summer before, and it was right before I came on board, Edmund. And the reason they chose it was, here's the history of it. The founder, Keene Addington, picked the first 3 restaurant sites just on gut. Now, he's a guy from Chicago and knows all the ins and outs, and he did a great job. Then he got scared. He said, oh my God, you know, I'm just doing this on my own gut. Maybe I better do some marketing research, which he did. And he did marketing research and found out what the ideal guest was. And then, interestingly enough, one of the employees said to him, oh, you know what, this would be great in Washington, D.C. I went to school there, and I know that this would be great there. So he went ahead and did the market research and worked with some realtors there, and that's how it matched. So that's how they picked Washington, D.C. I will tell you that moving to that market at that time might have been a little premature for this company, and that the infrastructure truly was not there, and it took a lot of resources to make that happen, and they actually happened 3 weeks apart, which was extra strain on the company. And, you know, there was, you know, of course they had the honeymoon period and sales were up and things looked rosy for the first few months. And then, as we all know, it takes about 6 months from the mistake that you make for it to impact the company. And about November, December is when we started to feel the impact of the results on the Chicago market, because all the resources have been pulled to Washington to pull that off. But I will say now they're doing great, and they've bounced back and worked very hard. One market is much easier to develop than the other. We have one in Cleveland Park, which I'm not sure if you know where that is. It's a small restaurant, very, very neighborhoody. And we've worked very hard to get that one up to par, but it's there now. The other one's in Arlington, Virginia, in a much busier area.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very good insight on your part, and as I look at my next opportunity, I'm thinking that's something that I'm going to look very, very carefully at. Because, it's the same mistake that, you know, Boston Market made, you know, some of the other really, really big ones. And I just think you have to be careful. And in my history at Let Us Entertain You, one thing Melman always said is, we're going to do it when we have the real estate, the money, and most importantly, the people, the right people. And I think you just need to be real careful about that before you move on to your second or third or 15th or 100th. You've got to be careful.
Mm. Go ahead.
No, right now, if you've got money, real estate's great. You know, now's the time to do it, because you're going to get some great long-term leases right now because, you know, of so much availability. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, speaking of Let Us Entertain You, you know, one of the things, I'm probably the only one that thinks this, but every once in a while I lift my head up and I go, you know, maybe I should be doing something else than being a restaurant owner. And I started thinking about other careers, yada, yada, yada. And I was just thinking, you know, what was going through your head? Because looking from the outside to be human resources, you know, at Let Us Entertain You with, 30, 40 units or whatever it was when you left, you know, what kind of thinking goes into behind that, where you would want to get out of that situation into another situation?
That's a great question. A couple of things. Number one, keep in mind that I'm from California, and I had a career out there for 8 years as a psychologist. And this whole thing coming to Chicago was a fun adventure. And I just lucked out working as a waitress in the lettuce restaurant when they had 6 restaurants. And I fell in love with the business. And when Melman approached me 10 months later, I'd only planned to stay a year, and everybody knew that. They knew that was a commitment I was giving them. And he approached me in a year and said, you know, we think you are, you know, leadership material. And, you know, it was a hard decision, but I was so in love with the business. And I said, okay, I'll give it a try. So I stayed, and I spent almost 3 years in operations. Did real well there, and then at that point, Lettuce was big enough where we could start, he wanted to start a human resource department, or as he always likes to say, and Bill, I know you heard this before, Lorette, let's start a human being department, which I always love.
Yeah.
But we've called it human resources, and gradually, I worked by myself for 2 years, gradually built that up. And I gotta be honest with you, the last 2 years, I got bored. I mean, we were doing all the human resource function, and I needed more. And I went to Rich, and I said, let's do consulting. And he was like, oh, I don't know if I'm ready for that yet. And I hung out a couple more years, and I just said, you know, I there's nothing more for me here. I was a partner, and, you know, I had my own department, and we had 5,500 employees. And I wanted to consult because keep in mind that I had not learned anything else other than the lettuce way. I mean, granted, it was, you know, among the best in the industry. So I went back to California and started my own consulting company, which I had for 5 years. We had 10 employees, and, you know, I went all over, and that's how Bill and I originally met. We would be on the same speaking roster at different conferences and so forth. Did a lot of consulting, loved it, loved it, loved it, loved it, and then I got recruited away. I never, ever intended to go back in the corporate world, and got recruited away to a real interesting little company out in California called Left at Albuquerque, and they had 5 restaurants at the time, and we built 3 while I was there. And I wore 2 hats there. I was a regional manager for the Southern California stores, even though I was in Northern California, and then I was also the CPO, Chief People Officer. And then from that point, I got recruited back by Keen, who's the founder of Flat Top Grill, who I had hired and trained 15 years before at Let Us Entertain You. And he had started this little company and said, you know, would you consider, you know, coming in and running it? So that's how it all happened.
Wow, thank you.
You're welcome. How about you? How'd you get started in it?
Just born and raised in the business. My family was in it, yes.
Forever.
Can I ask one more question?
Of course.
Okay. At Flat Top, can you talk a little bit about your marketing you know, and where, you know, where that's at, and what, you know, what your philosophy is, and what you're doing, and some of the things that have been more successful?
Sure. Marketing has a two-prong focus. One is corporate marketing, which is the big stuff, the development of the collateral, the Chinese New Year parties, all that big stuff. And corporate marketing keeps the budget on it, and then a percentage of that budget goes to local restaurant marketing initiatives, which the GM is part of their job description and performance review, and some people are more natural at it than others, and you've got to give them more support. But they all have quarterly marketing goals, both in terms of projects and in terms of results, and you work with them on it. We are very involved. Hotop is very involved in the community, very involved with the schools. There's always artwork on the walls in the restaurants from students, and that changes quarterly. I'm very involved with community activities with local theaters and arts and so forth. Lots and lots of community activities. So there's really two prongs to it. There's the big picture piece that corporate handles and monitors, and then there's local restaurant marketing initiatives that the GMs and the stores manage. And as I said, some of them take it like fish to water, and some of them don't. You know, they need to belong to their local chamber of commerce at least, and be involved in other local community organizations that help them develop their business.
Lorette?
Yes.
This is Tim from Calgary.
Tim?
I enjoyed being at Flat Top a couple times a couple years ago,
mm-hmm.
The one down by Oprah Winfrey's studio.
Oh, on Washington Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, just wondered, how is it positioned now? I didn't at that time get a. It seemed like a unit oriented position where it was and what it was doing. But is it a healthy? Is it a fun? Is it a? What
niche do you put it in?
Yeah, and what sort of personality does it put out there?
Okay. I would say that the concept itself falls in the casual dining, $15 or less area. In terms of the niche, it is definitely healthy. It's healthy and it can be unhealthy. Now there's 21 sauces and believe them, a lot of them have fat in them. And on the back, if you remember on the chalkboard behind the line is all the, each sauce and each, calorie intake, sodium, carbohydrate for every one of them. And some of them are quite caloric. But the thing that I liked about it was the variety. You have 22 vegetables, 21 sauces, 6 or 7 dishes you can choose from, all kinds of seasonings. And then in addition to that, you have the option to make it into a soup, a hot salad, mushu, put a roti prata, which is an Italian bread on top of it. I'm sorry, an Indian bread on top of it, or just have it regular stir fry. So, if you and I were going and you're a carnivore and I'm a vegetarian, we could each be happy. And the other thing that I like about it a lot is that if you make a mistake, you can go back. No, it's no penalty. I don't like what I did. But, of course, what we try to control that on the other end is by having your servers behind the line helping you as you go through so that you don't, you know, put two sauces together that wouldn't match or take one of the hot sauces and put three ladles on it and, you know, burn the skin off your tongue when you take your first bite. But I would say fun, very, very interactive, obviously, very high-spirited, and, as I said before, very neighborhoody. Now, the one that you're talking about, Tim, is down there in that West Loop area, which,
yep.
If you haven't been there in 2 years, have you been back since 2 years?
I've been to that neighborhood.
It's really developed.
It was a red light.
Red light and wishbone and... The whole area of lofts and so forth, there's nothing but building going on.
Yeah.
And it is a wonderful location for that reason. And every new condo that goes up, this is one of the local restaurant marketing initiatives. The GM goes over with packets of goodies, both food to eat and also, gift certificates and notices about us and so forth, and works very hard to become a neighborhood destination in that particular market. So... I don't know if I'm kind of all over the board answering your question here, but it's extremely interactive concept, very colorful, very fun, healthy or not. I mean, we have some killer desserts that are all homemade. And, you know, they're hardly healthy, but boy, are they good. Full bar. And it has mass appeal to everybody. I mean, my 82-year-old mother likes to go there. My girlfriends and I like to go, and my friends with their kids like to go. But I will tell you that the original target market was the young, professional, single female, 25 to 35, and they love it. Now, one other thing, and Kevin, I'm going to go back to your question about inventory and food cost and all. One other thing that's been a challenge here to Flat Top Grill has been to determine what your food cost is. Because in a restaurant on Belmont and Southport, the average guest is the woman that I just described, you know, maybe a 30-year-old single woman. She's going to eat one bowl full. If you go to Evanston, where Northwestern University is, the average is 3.8 bowls. So how do you calculate your food cost on that? Very, very carefully. Your ideal food cost has to be adjusted according to the location. Now, the one that you attended, Tim, the one on Washington Street, that's very heavily populated by the African-American community. And they eat a lot of meat. Also, our restaurant in Oak Park, a lot of meat goes out the door there. So it really depends.
Let me throw something else in, because I think most of the folks on are single unit operators or have a relatively small number of units. You said you were at Lettuce until it got to a certain point. They said, "Gee, we need an HR department." Is there anything that independent operators ought to be doing before they reach that point where they say, "Gee, we're big enough now, we need an HR department, or we need someone to be working on this full time"? Are there things that sort of fall by the boards because, well, we don't need that yet, when they really ought to be happening, and create a problem later on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that your senior financial person typically does a lot of HR things, the technical part, you know, the workers' comp and the unemployment insurance. And, you know, the benefits, because they're probably not too many while you're small. But I think the critical point is where the training cannot be done by the founder or the person the founder handpicked by themselves. When it becomes clear that training programs need to be written, that the selection process needs to be systematized, mostly so that you're not breaking any laws in that one. And, you know, now these days, again, though, you got to remember when I did it 20 years ago, you know, sexual harassment claims weren't as frequent then. Responsible sale of alcohol wasn't as serious a problem then as it is now. Foodborne illness, your search safe sanitation, all that now is so important. And, you know, at some point, and my sense is that when the leader or the person that leader handpicked, the founder, can't do it by themselves anymore. In other words, 500 employees, depending on what your turnover is. I mean, how are you going to train, in addition to everything else you have every year, if you've got 50% turnover, how are you going to train 250 people every year in addition to everything else you've got to do to nurture your business? And I think that's the point. That's when it has to be somebody who comes in at that point.
Is there anything that should be happening before that other than just basic survival technique?
Well, yeah. I mean, ideally, it all would be happening. The three things that always keep me awake at night, whether I was an operator, a VP of HR, or the president, are the safe serving of food, a sexual harassment claim, and a liquor liability. Those are the things that always worried me, and I always was really sure that we had excellent training done in those areas. And, you know, once you know those are in place and that people understand not only what's right to do by the law, but what's right to do morally, then I think that, you can move on to the other pieces of the human resource piece. But human resources, not only is selection and training, but it's, you know, it's the boring stuff. It's the compensation. It's the salary administration. It's the job descriptions, the performance review. It's all that sort of thing. And when you find, I think, that you reach a point where it's difficult to hold people accountable to the standards that you want your business run on, I think that's when you need to start buckling down and coming up with selection and training systems that will provide the standards and the clarity that employees need to hold them accountable.
Great. Thanks.
Lorette, when you were doing these weekly P&Ls and daily or hourly labors and things like that, how did you keep people out of offices, off of desks, and get away from the creeping bureaucracy? And
it's a great question, and there's a one-word answer: system. Your job is to make it as easy for them to complete the work and succeed as you can. And so you've got to think, you know, 8 steps ahead of them in terms of what they might need to complete this in the shortest amount of time. And you're right. If you're not careful, they're generating more useless reports. And that's not what you want them to do. You want them to be out interfacing with your guests, obviously.
Right. So you've just burdened them with more paperwork.
Well, it's so simple to do. I mean, you just show them how simple it is. You take your invoices. You know, our restaurants are $1.2 million or $1.4 million. You know, you don't get a lot of deliveries, a couple big Sysco deliveries a week, and, you know, your fresh produce and meat a couple times a week, and that's about it. If you can train them to take those invoices, and you train your GMs and your restaurant managers both, at the end of their shift, whatever was delivered, those invoices have to be entered. And if you can get them in the habit of doing that, it's a 15-minute maximum project. It's at the end of the night when they're doing the checkout. And the rest of it is on the Excel spreadsheet that falls into place. If you have your POS system interface with your Excel spreadsheet, and, you know, it virtually does the work for them. But it's a great question, and you cannot be expecting them to do all this big work. And I've seen that happen in companies that I consulted for. And so much of it is just unnecessary. And you have to be very careful of that, because you know what they'll do? They'll use it as an excuse.
Right.
Not to be out on the floor, which is where they really belong. But once they have the opportunity to see the difference in how they're spending and making money day in and day out, I'm telling you, the light bulbs that go on are amazing. Just amazing. And yeah, these managers used to come in at 9 o'clock. Well, guess what? They come in at 8 o'clock a couple days a week now, these GMs. Not because we told them to, but because they want to be there to understand it, to analyze it, to see what happened. They get as excited about getting the numbers as I did. You know, they look at their overtime. We do a nightly overtime report now so that they know week by week, I mean day by day, where they are in terms of their overtime. You know, we talk about what's expensive overtime, what's cheap overtime, when do you hire another person, when do you cross-train. And they come up with those questions just from learning the numbers. So I think it's a trade-off, but I think you're right. I think you have to be real careful not to bog them down with paperwork.
Well, there's something, because we were talking about the weekly P&L issue earlier, and one of the things that I think is real important, and we sort of talked around about, I don't know if we really pointed a finger at it, and that is that you don't throw this thing at people until you spend a lot of time with them to help them understand what these numbers are, what they mean, how this works, because otherwise it's real easy to just sort of toss it at them and assume that because we know it and understand it, they know it and understand it.
Yeah, and they really don't.
They don't have a clue.
No, and you're setting them up to fail, and once you do that, you've destroyed any hope that you have of ever teaching them, because you pissed them off. And number two, they are going to feel really bad about themselves because they failed. And, you know, you can't, you know, someone who's demotivated, they don't even want to learn anymore. So you're right, Bill, you have to go very slow. And that's where the leader has to think through the training piece. You know, it took us 4 months to get it perfect. And if it takes 4 months, guess what? The 4 months are going to go by anyway. And at the end of it, you're going to have much better business people who really understand. But you're right, you have to teach them. This is a P&L. You know, they used to get it at the end of the period, at the end of the period. They were handed it. And it was like, you didn't do good. Well, how do I do better? Well, don't worry about it. Just try it again next month. I used to say it was like giving some, putting some money in somebody's bank account at the beginning of the month, or checking account, and letting them write checks all month long, and at the end beat them up because there's no money in the account, so we're drawn. But I'm telling you, the life, and they pushed us. We actually had a longer timeline that we were going to give the process for them to learn. And they pushed us, and they beat us. I mean, they were so hungry for it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, I don't know, everybody gets nervous, oh God, we got to do this new thing and everybody's going to go crazy. But I think if it's done well and it's done right and it's done with respect and a lot of explanation and make it okay for them to not know what in the world you're talking about, when they get it, it really is neat.
Yeah. And you know, you've contributed to their careers and to their lives forever once you can teach them that.
But really what you're doing is you're giving them an accounting course, and they may not. I mean, if I remember back from my courses in accounting, a lot of that was a total foreign language for a while.
Yeah.
Until you start to get the drift of it.
Oh, it certainly was. Can you imagine me coming out of psychology?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I actually went to Northwestern and took a class, and I sat there, and I know my little eyes were spinning like pinwheels. I mean, I had no idea what it was about. And, you know, until I came back to the organization, and they started to teach us at Lettuce, you know, how to actually put that knowledge to reality of your day in and day out work. But we did it, Lettuce, we generated our own P&Ls, too, and then compared them to what corporate came up with.
Was that weekly at Lettuce?
It was not. It was it weekly? No, it was monthly. They were on a monthly period system there. No, it was monthly. But still, it was always fun to come back. And then you had to go sit in front of one of the senior VP founders. And, ooh, was he tough. Ooh, was he tough. But it was great because he had the invoices there for your store in front of him. And he would say, what's this charge? And you'd say, oh, I had an invoice for such and such. And you'd go, let's go through the stack and look at it. Why didn't you take this credit? Look at this. This, you know. And so he'd really, I mean, it was not, you know, it didn't tickle. But, boy, you learned a lot by going through that process. But that's how they taught us there.
Well, there's one other thing that, you know, because, again, I'll just go by the fact that there's been a lot of questions in this area that maybe some people are interested in it. I don't think that it's necessary to do a full P&L every week. I mean, certainly there are some key things that you need to know. Some of it is more work than that. I mean, what are you going to do with your phone bill? You know, some of that may not be, you know, as critical, at least in the beginning. So start with the major stuff and then add things as you go along, and they'll probably tell you what they want to add.
Yeah, that's a great idea. The only thing I'm going to caution you about in that case is don't call it a P&L. Just call it an operating report.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, that's true. But what we did, Bill, was we just estimated from, you know, history, from past trend reports, and plugged in a number, and we were usually pretty close. And then at the fourth week, you know, they reconciled the whole thing and got the right number in there. But, yeah, you're right, because sometimes your phone bill hits the third week and not the second or the first, you know, so you're right. But
well, I mean, I just always found that it's easier to take things in small bites, and that a lot of times there are great projects that never get started because you sit there and look at it and say, oh my God, you know, this is going to be a huge project, and say, well, just start with something, you know, start with giving sales information, and say, well, okay, well, you know, what can I give you, and then what's the next step, and we can do this, and we can add that, and you just add things as you go rather than trying to rise full grown.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And then what we did at corporate was we had a sales chart on the wall, and every week when the numbers came in, the sales numbers, you know, we would, you know, fill in the red, like a little, it's like a little thermometer. And then when I did the GM meeting once a month, I would talk them through, you know, what was our goal, where are we in terms of sales, what's the percentage, where are we from last year, let's do it store by store. We did it for each, you know, the food, the liquor, the Holy Trinity, the food, the liquor, and the labor. And all of a sudden, they were beginning to see patterns, and they were pointing out things to each other. you know, we got into capital budgets. I mean, they never understood that before. It was very cool. But you're right, Bill. You're absolutely right. And like I said, we had a 6-month timeline to teach it to them, and they mastered it in 4, which I was extremely proud of them for.
I have a question, but let us entertain you.
Sure.
It's always mystified me how they pull off such different concepts, different ethnic, Benpow and the Greek play, Papagos and Shaw's and Big Bowl, and they all are well done and so different.
Well, first of all, Melman's a genius. You got to start with that. There's no question about that and his level of creativity. But I also will tell you that it's a lot of hard work. I can remember, and the other thing I want to start out by saying is it always starts with the food, always with the food. He has an idea. We tasted food till we thought we were going to throw up from it. This and that and this and that and this. The chefs would get on it. And once he realized that he could do the food at the price point for the concept that he wanted to create, then we would move forward. The other thing I want to say is he's a genius, but he is a study genius. When we were doing Ed DeBevick's, I can remember walking in his office. He must have had 50 books on diners on the floor. He studied and studied and studied. Or when they did, you know, Brasserie Joe, the French bistro, over to France, pictures of the lights, pictures of poles, pictures of entrances, pictures of pictures, pictures, pictures. I mean, it's very, very studied. And he has them with him as they're designing the restaurant and actually as they're building it. He'll walk in and he'll say, now I want to change this, or, you know, let's put an arch here. I mean, he's, you know, he's a true entrepreneur in that way. He says he monkeys with things. I just monkey with it till it feels right. But it always starts with the food, and it's very, very studied, very studied. And then as we, my level of partners, you know, we were, they used to call us the junior levers, the junior partners. Now we're, you know, all old enough to be called senior partners. But in those days, we were the junior partners, and somebody would get a bent for something, like Kevin Brown. I'm from the East Coast. I want to do a fish house. All right? Let's start studying it then. What are we going to do? Let's talk about the food. And then they get the food down. Now what designs? And they'd go to Boston or wherever, Providence, wherever they would go, and they'd look at, eat at restaurants. Well, we thought we were going to die. I remember the first time I went with Melman to New York. There were several of us. I forget what we were researching, something. And he said, you know, eat light steak because we're going to go out to dinner tonight. I'm like, okay, fine. Well, he didn't tell me we're going to go to 10 places and order everything on the menu. That's what I mean by studying. I mean, and I'd love to watch the waiter's face. They'd walk up and they'd go, can I get you something to drink? And Rich would go, no, we're just going to have coffee, or just water, but bring me the whole right side of the menu. The kid would look at him like he was nuts, but he'd bring the whole right side of the menu. But that's what it is. It's a studied creativity. Very, very disciplined.
But is there like a shelter organization over each one, or does it just fit into the I'm not sure what I'm saying. It seems to me there needs to be a champion of each distinct concept.
I think this will help you. Each partner had a division they were in charge of.
Okay.
One was in charge of the Italian division, one was in charge of the fish division, one was in charge of the, we used to call it the fancy pants division, which is your higher end. And that's how that all worked. One was in charge of the division that had entertainment, and that's how it worked. And Richard was brilliant with the way he set up the succession plan strategy. If you wanted to open another restaurant in your division, you had to make sure that the GM at one of your current restaurants had the management developed below him or her so that he could move out and open another one. And if they did not, if they said, oh yeah, you know, Tim is ready, he can go, he can take over the restaurant now, just because they were chomping at the bit to do a new one, if that restaurant had a blip in the screen in terms of sales and profits, that manager who pushed the envelope too hard had to go back and run it again. And he only had to do that twice that I'm aware of. And everybody got the message. We're about quality, not being the biggest. And he owes you to say. We're about being the best, not about being the biggest or the richest. And he still believes that to this day. He's a stickler for excellence. But I think that might help you understand that. Also, I will tell you that each restaurant was its own sub-S corporation. And as a partner, you might have had a piece of one and not a piece of another. So it was really brilliant the way he set it up that way to really keep the motivation there. But overall, Let Us Entertain You is the, you know, the corporation name, but each individual restaurant also had a corporate name.
Right.
Or if you could put a different hat on, if you were back at, if you had came into Flat Top and it only had one unit at the time, hypothetically, as you are looking at one unit and you're thinking about building it into a chain, you know, what are your thoughts? You know, what are you thinking about as CEO? What are you doing?
Okay. Well, first off, I'm going to look at the unit economics and see how realistic they are compared to some of the industry averages. That's number one. Second thing I would do would be I would stay close to home. I would not go far for a lot of reasons. If your first restaurant... Your first restaurant's probably in an area that you know well. Branch out a little bit and look at the model from every angle. Who's your guest? What is the restaurant? Where is it positioned in the city? Why is that good? Why is it bad? How do we do at lunch? How do we do at dinner? But I would say the main thing I would say is don't go too far too fast. Don't, you know, when I joined Left at Albuquerque, they were doing the same thing. I joined there, they had five restaurants. And they had a VP of real estate out looking in Atlanta and New York and Orlando and Chicago, and we were in Palo Alto, California. I said, what are we doing? Oh, we have to prove we have legs. And I said, I talked him out of it. I said, you don't have the infrastructure to prove you have legs. Open a couple more close to home. But when you know what, Flat Top Grill, I mean, clearly Midwesterners love it. And I used to get emails twice a week. People, oh my God, open one in San Francisco. Oh my God, open, it would do so great in Seattle. Well, you're probably right, but it doesn't serve the company's resources well to stretch itself that thin. So I think my advice would be look at the unit economics, try to duplicate that two or three more times in the same, you know, general region before I would go out, because it's when you take that step out, if you're not prepared, that you're walking, taking a step into thin air, and it could get really scary.
I'll admit it's wonderful for your ego to get these raving letters from real estate guys that say, I've got a great, you are such a great operator, and I've got this great site, and we'll work you a great deal, and all the rest of it, and be real, real careful.
Yeah,
it's wonderful, right. Strokes for the ego, but...
Oh, you're right to say, oh, we're in two markets. Well, you know, when people tell you that, you know, you don't know if one of the markets is killing them to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to just be really careful. Yeah, I think that's good, Bill. I think ego is a really something that you have to be really grounded with. Just, you know, don't get your ego in the way.
Well, it's easy to rationalize because, you go, well, you know, we could take these expenses and we could amortize those, flip those now over three or four places, and you can talk yourself into it. I mean, God knows I've done it.
Yeah.
You can talk yourself into some really stupid stuff. And I think maybe the best bet is, if nothing else, just have somebody who is outside of your immediate market, whose opinion you trust, who can tell you when you're totally full of it, and that you'll listen to them.
Well, that's great. And another thing I wanted to add to that was, you know, I don't know what exit strategies you're working on, but if your exit strategy is to build it to, I don't know, 7 or 10 restaurants and then have a Brinker or a Darden or, you know, McDonald's come and buy the concept, guess what? They've got the money and the real estate contacts to take it to New York, Washington, D.C., Seattle, Minneapolis. That's not what they're looking at. They're looking at the unit economic model. Can this thing make money? Even before corporate expenses, because if a McDonald's buys a Chipotle grill, that's all the corporate stuff is going to get rolled into the corporate they already have. So you don't need to worry about, anything other than the unit economics. And they know, you know, I had a realtor tell me not too long ago, you know, I kept saying we were looking in, where the heck were we looking? I think it was in Indianapolis. And he said to me, I said, I can't find anything good there. He said, well, you know why? Because the anything you're looking at, you can bet that the Dardens and the Brinkers and the McDonald's have already turned down. They're the ones that get the first phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was, I had not even thought about that before. So going back to my original point, if you want to duplicate and your liquidation plan is to have it, you know, bought off, then just work on your unit economics and keep it close to home and prove over and over and over that you can do the same thing, that you can replicate it. That's what they're looking for. Who's this Fishbone? Is that the one that Brinker just bought in Dallas? Fish, isn't it called Fishbone?
There's one in Orlando called Fishbone.
That's not the right... Redfish, maybe?
Redfish, I think.
Yeah, well, they just got bought. They're all in Dallas. The kid didn't take it anywhere else. But focus on quality, outstanding unit economics. Brinker picked it up. They'll do with it. What they try to do is they try to find concepts that they can take to $100 million. So all you got to do is prove that you can do it, you know, 5, 7, 10 times, and they'll take it from there and pay you for the concept.
I think if you want to prove anything, stay in. I mean, I would totally agree with you, Lorette, that, you know, closer is better than spread out just for the just for your own mental health. But you know, you might, if you want to get, you know, play around a little bit, you might look at, you know, different segments of that market. Can it work in a community of, you know, 20,000, can it work in your community of 50,000, you know, still within workable area?
Mm-hmm.
You might look at a few things that way, but don't decide, gee, this is great, let's go to Atlanta, let's go to Dallas, let's go to Denver.
Right.
What about in terms of looking at your operation and just looking, how do you look at Flat Top every day and say, okay, you know, this needs to be improved, or as far as the pizzazz or the packaging of it or whatever, the things that make it special?
You have to, it's a great question. Who's this? Is this Edmund?
This is Edmund, yes, ma'am.
Edmund, how, you know, you have to constantly reinvent yourself without destroying your concept. You're absolutely right. And you have to listen to people. You got to listen to your guests. And I mean you. I don't mean the managers of the service. I mean you. You got to get out there and talk to them. I don't mean your marketing research crowd. I mean you. You got to talk to them. You got to talk to the servers. What are you hearing? What are people liking? What are they not liking? You know, the main thing we heard was that there weren't enough recipes to choose from. So we came up with a little recipe card that sits on the table. It's laminated. They can take with them or not. It's two-sided. It changes every season. You know, another one was we would like more appetizers. So we came up with, you know, really creative appetizers, both individuals and ones you could share, that were very splashy, are very colorful, in keeping with the theme. But if you listen to people, they will tell you. I mean, there's just no question about it. But
you just have to be prepared to hear things that are different than what you thought you were going to hear.
Well, that's right. That's right, Bill. And there's that ego issue again.
Yeah.
That's the ego issue again. And, you know, I could tell you, yeah, go hire a consultant and come up with a brand statement. And, you know, that doesn't hurt. But, you know, if you have one or two or three units, I think that's a waste of money. I think you listen to the people. They're telling you what your brand is. And whereas this organization was started thinking it was a 25 to 30 or 5-year-old woman, now we know we have mass appeal. We have appeal to many more people.
Sorry, Lorette, what was that about the recipe cards?
Well, we are a concept where you create your own stir fry.
Yes.
And so we have chalkboards around the restaurant that have recipes on them that change every season, but they weren't enough. They weren't enough. And so what the guests were saying is, we need more ideas. You know, are somebody there?
Yes.
Okay. We need more
Edmund,
ideas.
I think that's Edmund's vice president of marketing.
Marketing, sorry, guys.
What goes well with this? What can we do for our kids and so forth? So we had our executive chef, who designed all the sauces, come up with different recipes. And it's a long, narrow card that actually fits in the sugar caddy. And there's a similar one, by the way, that's dessert that's brought out at the end of the meal. It fits in the sugar caddy. They're very bright and colorful. But
you have created your own stir-fry desserts?
No, I'm sorry. It just describes the dessert.
Okay, sorry.
Although, you know what? It's a very good point. You're about the 10th person I've had say that. Why don't you do a create your own dessert menu? So, you know, that's something that I'm hearing now, so you think about things like that. But at any rate, it's a long, narrow card that they can take with them up to the food line and actually read and create the recipe right off of the food that's there if they don't want to be creative.
So it'd be like Kung Pao chicken or something
exactly.
Not so spicy.
Exactly. Pad Thai or any, you know, he comes up with 8 new ones every season.
Well, we're kind of getting close on time here, so I thought let me throw this out, and I think we could probably stay with this for hours, and I didn't have an agreement going in that I could keep you for hours, Loretta, so I'd like to see if anybody's got burning questions in closing that we haven't had a chance to address yet.
None from here.
Well, I like to comment, Doug, where I've been in probably 80% of these, and this has been one of the best ever that, and some of the best information. This is Edmund speaking, but some really good stuff out of your tape and out of this discussion. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That feels really nice. I appreciate that.
Listen, I appreciate you all taking the time. I know there's always a lot of things on your plate. It isn't always the most convenient thing to say, well, gee, let me break away and sit on the phone for an hour, but I hope there's been some good information in this, and I hope it's something that you'll, you know, stick on your calendar for upcoming teleconferences.
I will be. This first one, and I really enjoyed it. I've got some really good information to take.
Good.
So, Rorez, the next Chicago show, you don't mind if all 10 of us or 5 of us drop in on you?
Heck no. We'd love it.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And good conversation.
Loretta, thanks so much.
Take care.
Okay, Bill, my pleasure. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great.